Welcome to Partners for Progressive Israel podcast. I'm your host, Nicole Cooper, and I'm in Jerusalem at Rabbis for Human Rights with Rabbi Yehiel Groniman. We're going to talk today about Jerusalem Day, or Yom Yerushalayim, and the Jahalin Bedouin. Yom Yerushalayim is important to talk about as it is a festive time and also a time of violence and racism. Without further ado, I will let Yehiel introduce himself and the topics.
So, I'm Rabbi Yehiel Groniman. For the last 8 years, I've been Director of Activities in the Occupied Territories for Rabbis for Human Rights, founder member of this organization. I've been involved since 1988, and I'm actually going to be doing different things now when we find a young replacement. We're looking, if anyone out there is looking for a job for a young rabbi or rabbinical student who knows some Arabic and wants to be active. That's generally.
That sounds pretty good.
I'll explain that. Just mention one positive thing that I participated in last night. A member of Rabbis for Human Rights, who used to be the student representative for the conservative rabbinical school, Tamar Elad Applebaum, who's a wonderful young leader, organized with some other religious people prayer and music evening at the Tachana Rishona, Jews and Arabs together, which was really wonderful and was well attended. Maybe 1,000 people, 700 to 1,000 people were there. So after a very challenging day out in the field, it was a wonderful way to end the day. And there are decent people on both sides who really do want to see positive change. So, to your question, Jerusalem Day is the day that the Israeli paratroopers conquered the old city. And there's a history connected with that. I was alive at 15. I remember the events. So for me, there is an aspect of the day which is a sense that Israel succeeded in defending itself against threats from outside, and that was part of the story. And the politicians say they spoke to Hussein, who was then the king of Jordan, to stay out of the battle with Egypt and Syria, and he didn't. And then they took over the old city. And for that generation, who had been involved in the expulsion of Jews from the old city at the time of the Israeli War of Independence, it was a very emotional thing. Had it stopped there, and had there been real negotiations for peace, maybe they could have come up with some kind of solution. But what happened in 1967, and I remember the emotions, was the cork was taken out of the bottle of religious nationalism, who had been junior partners in the Zionist movement back then, and were a moderate influence. And the consequence of messianic passions led to a huge change, which yesterday we see the results of. So the yearly march through the old city to the Kotel, to the Wailing Wall, or the Western Wall, is something that was organized by some leaders of a yeshiva called Merkaz Rav Kook, which in many ways was the home of Gush Emunim, the Block of the Faithful, which was the most powerful single group in the settler movement. These are people who believe in Greater Israel. These are people who have a notion that what's going on here is divinely inspired. And so the process of Jews taking over the land that was promised to them, according to the Bible, should be irreversible. And whenever any land has been returned, even land that isn't described in the Bible as part of the land of Israel, like Sinai, they're in mourning. Amongst those people, there are people with also influenced by a rabbi called Meir Kahana, who's an American import, who brought a weird, distorted kind of mirror reflection of racist ideologies from Europe. I think he's influenced by Nazism, the reaction to Nazism. The reaction is we do to them what they did to us, which is pretty scary, terrible stuff. And those people are a minority in the crowd that marched through the old city. But just the march every year with flags through the old city is already obviously going to be causing friction, and has year after year. Rabbi Zvi Human Rights are, I personally represent the organization, are members of a coalition of religious educational organizations that have been fighting hate crimes and racism for the last few years, about 49 organizations. They're less radical than we're labeled as. And they went to court with another organization, Ir Amim, which is an NGO focused on issues of Jerusalem, to try and having first turned to the police and asked the police, please change the route of this march because of what happens in the old city, and were turned down by the police, went to court. And the court was critical, but said, oh, you have a democratic right to march. And yes, they marched, but they called the police commissioner of Jerusalem in, said, you know, you should be arresting people who are chanting things like death to the Arabs, which happens every year, or the kids who come through. I saw them yesterday with their sticks smashing windows and stuff like that. So what is, in the eyes of very nationalistic people, supposed to be a joyful day of returning to, ancient city of Jerusalem, which, by the way, was also the site of significant growth of Jewish population in the 19th century. The majority of the people living in the old city in 1840 were already Jews. They were poor religious Jews who started moving out of the walls. So when they were expelled by the Jordanians, this was also seen by the nationalists as a tragedy. The court said you would arrest people. I don't know how many people arrested yesterday. It's a huge march. People bust in from settlements all over the West Bank. It's an organized thing. Yeshivas and Ulpanot, that's Gauls, yeshivas, are brought collectively. And for some people, it's a family day. They have picnics and they have balloons and toys. And, you know, there is that side to it. But there's also a side which is profoundly disturbing to anyone who's concerned about democracy and human rights and respect of the other, because part of the spirit of this is we're going to show them who's in control of the city. It's our city, it's not yours. And Benjamin Netanyahu made a speech yesterday saying, you know, Jerusalem's the eternal capital of the Jewish people and it will never be divided again, that sort of thing. So that's about general background to the day. What was the second question?
Just about, like, do you think that the entrance through Damascus Gate and down the main street is deliberate to stir up tension, or is it just that it's a good route to the Kotel, or is it because it claims the land? Like, why not go through Jaffa Gate? Like, what's the
All those things thought? Are part of the story. Before the High Court hearing, I and another religious activist, a guy called Gadi Gvaryahu, leads this Tag Meir group that we're part of. That's the name given. It's a light tag, which is a strange name, but it's a reaction to something called Tag Mechir, which is price tag, which means vengeance actions. It's a reaction to people trying to arson mosques and putting graffiti on churches saying Jesus is whatever it is, a bastard, and so on. Some of the things that are most graffiti are what some of these kids chant in the old city. We were speaking to a guy called Yaakov Emdan or Memdan or something like that, who was one of the founders of the NGO that is organized just to arrange this march every year. And he was very upset that, of course, that we were going to court. He said, well, you need to go to court with all those leftists and so on. His argument was, we have to go through, 10,000 people come, we can't all go through the Jaffa Gate, we have to go through lots of gates. In fact, they wanted to go through Lion's Gate, which is where the paratroopers broke into the old city in 67. There must be an aspect of truth to that, that if you have a lot of people, you need to go from a lot of places. But what I heard from the kids in the street, I heard kids dragging other kids away from a left-wing demonstration of Jerusalem isn't silent to racism. That's a translation of Yerushalayim lo shoteket legizanut. I also participated in that demonstration before I went to give out flowers with the more soft left people. I heard settler kids telling other settler kids, what are you yelling at these guys for? We're not here to fight with Jews, i.e. we're here to fight with Arabs, right? And I mean, the slogans on some of their shirts, Jerusalem is ours and only ours, it'll be ours forever. Those are positive messages which have a very strong negative implication. It's ours, not yours, right? So marching through the Damascus Gate and through the Muslim Quarter, I think, isn't only about the practical logistics. It's about something else. It's clearly about showing them who's boss, and people talk that way.
Yeah, it's definitely making presence known kind of thing.
By the way, I have a friend, an Orthodox rabbi, he's also a member of Rabbis for Rights, not active, but he was on the board once, who has a, he's remarried, has a stepson who is in the border guards. And unlike my friend Mordechai, he's on the right. He said he hates Jerusalem Day. He says it's an awful, terrible day for the police and the army, because it's a huge logistics headache. And they get it from both sides. They get it from the Palestinians, who are really angry about being blockaded and put under curfew and not allowed to move around. There are some Palestinians that come into town to taunt the police and throw rocks at the police, so it increases the tension anyway. They get it from that side. And they get it from some of the some of these right-wing people who say, why are you protecting the Arabs and stuff like that?
The area just outside Damascus Gate and inside of Damascus Gate is basically a market. Vegetable stands, general shops, people everywhere. On this day, the streets are closed off, and Palestinians are shoved up against guardrails, kind of waiting for something to happen as the Israelis are marching through and singing songs. There's riot cops, army, mounted cops. I was inside the Old City for most of it, filming to make sure nothing too horrible happened, or if it did, that it was documented. I was right on the main street on the way to the Kotel where everyone was marching to. This one young settler guy stopped me to explain to me that I was the problem because I was filming. And I was trying to explain to him, well, what am I doing wrong if I'm filming? Who's the one really doing something wrong? Is that you? Me? I don't know.
There's another reason, by the way, that's in this settler movement. People who are modern Orthodox, some of them moved over to a more ultra-Orthodox position. And B'nai Akiva, the youth movement, used to have boys and girls dancing together in the 1950s. I remember that. And today they separate the gender. And one of the things that they claim is we send the girls through Jaffa Gate and the boys through Damascus Gate to separate them.
Mm-hmm.
Because they think that being together will create promiscuity or whatever. So that's another element in this crazy mix that happens. It's a miracle that, I think, you know, if I have criticism of the police, I think their orientation, they're holding in place an occupation of an occupied people, and they suffer from the role they play. I think they do actually an incredible job every year, considering the numbers of people that come through the Old City. It's almost a miracle that bad things happen, but the worst things don't happen. Because mm-hmm. It wouldn't take much.
Yeah, I saw a police officer asking a Palestinian shopkeeper to close his shop, and basically the essence was, he knows he can't protect me and my shop, so he's just like, dude, please just close, back yourself up. He wasn't being rude at all, just kind of... Help yourself out, help me help you.
they get told to keep their cool. Look, I've heard policemen say things that shows that they tend to be on the right. They tend to, you know, there's some degree of racism amongst the police. But they got a really strong message to keep things cool. And, I mean, you know, there could be a lynching one day on this either side. Because the tempers are very hot. Mm-hmm. And it's like... excuse the language, all the shit that goes on all year is focused on this day. It's all there. Like, at least there are people marching through there saying the temple is ours, or rebuild the temple, or blow up Al-Aqsa, and stuff like that, which is really, it's one of the biggest fears of the Muslims. Actually, mm-hmm. It goes back to 1929. They had riots. I don't know how much they really understood what Zionism was. It took them a while. but they understood that the Jews pray for rebuilding a temple. They know about that.
Yeah. And I guess just to wrap up on this section, people have been working toward making the march less violent and racist, and encouraging people to not sing racist songs. And I think it seemed like that sort of worked this year. I know some...
There was a report that it was a little calmer this year.
Yeah. That's really great. And I think my friend was saying that rabbis asked their yeshiva students to, you know, tone it down a little, and I think it was...
Well, I think that's what the court said.
Yes.
The court made a statement in that direction. The police sent out instructions. And, you know, in the right-wing community, the right-wing religious community, they are concerned about the extremists in their midst that gives them a bad name. So they're worried about that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Rav Kook, that their center is named after, there was Rav Kook the father, Rav Kook the son. Tzvi Yehuda was the son, and he was a very, very nationalist. He was alive at the time of 67, and he said to his students, you've got to go and settle every inch of land. And it sounds to me almost like fascism, that the army is holy, that sort of thing. I can understand where the emotions are coming from, my family history, you know, child of Holocaust survivors, and they thought that Jews having an army is a wonderful thing. I understand that. But when it's given the shtempel, the mishpacha, the kosher certificate of absolute, it's dangerous stuff. The father, who was the first chief rabbi of Palestine under the British mandate, Abraham Cook, he was a nationalist. He wanted the whole land and all that. But there's some interesting things about him. The guy was a vegetarian. He didn't think the Jews needed an army. And he preached love of mankind, a lot of material. So he's a nationalist, a maximalist, but he's also someone who sees the Jewish people as a vehicle for human redemption. And he, when there were riots in 1929, and people were killed on both sides, he went out and yelled at his yeshiva students that you should speak to Arabs and relate to them respectfully.
Mm. Jerusalem is only a small part of the big picture of all the issues happening in Israel and Palestine. The issues around the Bedouin communities are especially important to know about, and today we'll talk about the Jacqueline Bedouin, since Rabbis for Human Rights has worked with them since 1997. Yahiel, I would love for you to explain about the impacts of the settler movement on the Bedouin, the uprooting in the 1950s, and how their traditional way of life was compromised after the War of 1967.
Well, I don't know, but what I know.
Sure.
Okay, so first of all, something I've learned about the Jalin is they're very low in the local Arab hierarchy. There are various reasons. I mean, they've been described, people tell me this, publicize it, you know, as smugglers and thieves and not dependable. They're known as illiterate. The Jalin have been making a tremendous push amongst themselves for literacy and for education, the ones I know. So if we go back to the 50s, what happened in the 50s was that Israel started to conscript Bedouin to the Israeli army. And the background to that was deals they did with Bedouin chieftains, sheikhs, or muhtars, the Bedouin communities. And the Bedouin, unlike city Arabs, Palestinians, or Falahim, the farming villagers, they were semi-nomadic. They had their summer and winter grounds, whatever, but they weren't nationalistic. And so a lot of the chieftains did a deal with Israel, you know, we'll participate, we'll send our guys to the army, and you'll be nice to us. And for a while there was peace between the Israeli authorities and the Bedouin, even though the Bedouin got a raw deal, and it's a whole issue around Bedouin rights in the Negev. The Jalin tribe, which is from the Tel Arad area, I happen to be a rabbi of a conservative synagogue in Arad for 6 years. They crossed the border into Jordan, and I've heard different stories. Basically, because their muhtar refused to do a deal with the Israeli authorities, They didn't want their kids to go to the Israeli army. And they crossed to the Arab side, to the Arab-controlled side. That's one explanation. Another explanation I've heard is that they were forced out by Israel. Israel did some reshuffling of populations, moved Bedouin out of the way of the battles, and then didn't let them come back. That's part of the story of El Arakib. That's been an issue for years. Some of those Bedouin moved to Hebron area, and some of them moved to area east of Jerusalem. They spread out basically along the Jordan Valley. They were supposed to, what I've heard from one person from the UN, go to UN refugee camps near Jericho, but they didn't cooperate with the UN either. Many of them are still defined as refugees, and they get rations from UNRWA. Some of them have no papers at all. About 7,000 on the desert, and there's some suspicion on the part of other Palestinians that they're have cousins who serve in the Israeli army, so maybe they're not to be trusted. That's another issue they have. Which, on the other side of it, as a patriotic Israeli, there's something more comfortable about dealing with Bedouin because they're not so anti-Israel. It's changing. I mean, first of all, they moved away. If they moved away not to go to the army, there's an element of Arab nationalism going on there, maybe. Whatever the case is, the Bedouin weren't well treated under the Jordanians, even though Jordan's elite is Bedouin. They were neglected, basically. They were, you know, they had their places where they grazed. But what really changed things was when Israel conquered the West Bank. When Israel conquered the West Bank, it was more and more difficult for them to move around. What had been a loosely controlled area of the desert came under more tight control, military control. Israel in 68 froze changes in land titles. And I'm wondering whether there wasn't some idea in mind that we were going to be able to build settlements. Settlements were built, and I'm giving a lecture to your group on Thursday about building settlements. Settlements were built in these areas, and they started encroaching on the freedom of movement of the Bedouin. Most of the settlements are built near water sources. The Bedouin, to graze their flocks, are very dependent on water sources. So that already started drying up their way of life. Then there were army bases built. And then later there had been developed also Palestinian expansion or development, particularly east in the area of villages around East Jerusalem. After the Second Intifada, when they built the wall, they then lost their major market in East Jerusalem for their meat and their milk. They live off their herds. They used to live off their herds. So they were already poor, but they became impoverished. There's something like 80% unemployment amongst them. They're really dependent on the sacks of flour that they get. They live off, still off the herds that are left that they haven't sold. Much more limited grazing lands and often menial labor. You know, they work in the garbage dump of Jerusalem, they work in gas stations, they work in the whole factory system or warehouse system in Mishor Adumim. The area east of Jerusalem, there is a few places that are called red because the sand is reddish color. So the Jewish settlements of Male Adumim, Adom is red, it's red heights. And Mishor Adumim, which is a red plain, and Kfar Adumim, red village. These are a group of settlements that have displaced Bedouin. We got involved in the Bedouin issue in the 1990s when Male Adumim was expanded and Bedouin were kicked off lands that they were on and forcibly settled near the Jerusalem rubbish dump next to the Arab village, which is really part of the municipal. Not municipal, the urban area of Jerusalem, Azaria, involved in protests, involved in lobbying, and then educational work, which we've been doing ever since. With that bit, it's a few hundred people, that bit of the tribe. Let me ask some questions. I go on and on and on.
So how did Rappers for Human Rights first approach them in 1997? Like, how did that relationship actually form?
I don't know all the details.
Do you know? Yeah,
yeah,
I didn't know
what
if you
I
knew.
know is that before me in this job that I'm doing, because I'm responsible for volunteers, is Rabbi Jeremy Mogram. And Jeremy had to find things for biblical students to do, because people studying a year in Israel from HUC and JTS needed to do some social project. And some of them were interested in Arab-Israeli conflict. So how exactly Jeremy made contact with the job, I don't know. I got my contact with them through him, through that demonstration that we participated in. And then he invited me up to meet, to see, actually have coffee in a bit of a tent. And when I came to the job here, Jeremy asked me to please continue the stuff he'd been doing. Actually felt like Arif was preoccupied with other more political things and not so interested in the Bedouin.
What are some of the challenges of working with the Bedouins, and what are the positive changes you've been able to make?
First of all, is language limitations. I don't speak Arabic. So I'm dependent on contacts that are English-speaking or Hebrew-speaking. Positive things. I think we have a certain degree of trust with certain Bedouin leaders, Abu Suleiman, Abu Khamis, Abu Riyad. It's not just a matter of drinking coffee. They turn to us for help, not that we can always help, because they know we understand the occupation system and we can call officers and stuff like that. So that's positive. I think that's positive. More positive than that is the work we've been able to do, particularly with this woman, Ibtissam, who is educated. It's kind of tragic. Being an educated woman in the Bedouin community is really hard and limiting. I don't know, it's probably harder for her. I think harder for her to get married. She's overeducated for her community. But she's been working to provide activities after school for kids. School is very truncated, very limited. There's no money. And the boys drop out of school almost overwhelmingly because it's easier for a 14-year-old or 15-year-old boy to get some low-paying job than it is for the men. So they bring home money. And so then some of the girls get an education. And it's a positive thing. Your change, I mean, women are a motor of change in traditional communities. There are problems with the men, actually. They sort of try and limit the movement of women, for instance. Ibtissam was asked to do work in other Bedouin encampments, and the answer is no, she can't. There are other clans. She accepts the authority of her father. He's a lovely guy, but that's part of the reality she lives in. That relationship is positive. It's not without challenges. I don't, you know, Bedouin have become more engaged in fundamentalist Islam than they were before. It's another issue of tension within the Palestinian community, because Bedouin were suspect as not good Muslims. They're not as hierarchical. They are very hierarchical in terms of the clan and the tribe, but in terms of Muslim clergy and building mosques, they have this huge mosque there that was donated to them, basically, and they've become more religious, and they've become more nationalistic. Their educators come from Ramallah and from Palestinian towns. Maybe it's a positive thing, they're getting integrated into Palestinian society, but that's a challenge for us. We sometimes get told, don't come, when things happen, because they're angry at the Israelis, things like that.
Right. And is there any way of knowing, you might not know this at all, maybe no one knows, of knowing how many, or if Bedouins want to go back to Telluride and live a traditional life, or if they want to be more urban, or is it generational, or like how?
That's a good question.
Yes.
I'll tell you what the Bedouin leaders say when they're asked is, we want to go back to Telluride. What I don't know is to what extent they say that because they mean it, to what extent they say it because they have to say it, because that's a Palestinian position, right of return. Sorry.
It's okay.
Hello?
In just this 45-minute interview, Yahiel's phone rang twice and got texted once, mostly by the same person. It reflects the scheduling here, as things are always up in the air depending on the incident of the day or difficulties at checkpoints. Planning is a bit rough, so excuse the phone call. Okay, he's ready again.
I can't tell you an answer with any certainty. The official position of their leadership is we want to go back to Telerat, and if we can't go back to Telerat, then we want to stay where we are. We do not want to be displaced again. And we haven't spoken about this, but the context in which they live is the threat of another expulsion. The army sees where they are as a problem. They're in the way of army development and practice or training grounds, or in the way of expansion of settlements. They don't. They're squatters. They don't have land rights like other Palestinians. So there are Bedouin who could show a letter from local Palestinians, say we're happy to have them stay on this land, and a couple of places where that's happened. But there's also conflict between Bedouin and other Palestinians over land. So I'll be honest. The government or the army, civil administration of the army, that's the colonial wing of the army in Area C, wanted to move other Bedouin to the Jabal, to the hill next to Azariya, where this rubbish dump is supposed to be closed so there would be more land available. That was supposed to happen in 2006. The city rubbish dump is still functioning, and they're right now clearing an area to relocate Bedouin that are around the Male Adumim area to there. There'd be protests against that. But there are more Bedouin than the 1,000 or so in that area. There's, we said 7,000, another 6,000. And they're talking about relocating them to near Jericho. So most of the Bedouin structures in Area C have demolition orders. They've been issued demolition orders. They're told you're here illegally, you're not supposed to be here. In that context, when they say we want to go back to Tel Aran, they might mean it. They might be saying what they need to say for Palestinian public relations. It's probably a little each of those. But they also say we want to stay where we are, and we don't want to be relocated or be made refugees a second time. That's the official position. There's been a continual movement of some Bedouin from these encampments into the Palestinian cities. There are Bedouin that break away from the traditional framework. And often, particularly men who do get an education, they move into Ramallah, into Anata, into Azariya. Apart from the Bedouin living in the Bedouin community on the Jabal, there are a lot of other Bedouin who are Palestinians living in the city of Azariya. That is, I think, what the Israeli government wants. It wants them out of the way. It wants Palestinians, also from little villages and Bedouin, to move into the Palestinian enclaves. Mm-hmm. The Palestinians themselves, I think, are ambivalent. On the one hand, they want the Bedouin to be part of Palestinian society and more nationalistic and more educated. That's one side. On the other hand, they want them to hold on to the land for future Palestinian state. So there are contradictions there.
Do you think the Bedouins identify with Palestine and feel Palestinian, or they just feel Bedouin?
I think more and more they feel Palestinian.
Yeah.
There's a hierarchy of things. This Palestinian identity also something that's developed. So, I mean, they know themselves to be number one, Bedouin, number two, Arab, number three, Muslim. But I think that's their order. The Bedouin in the Negev also, some of them call themselves Palestinian, the ones that are more politically conscious. But they're Israeli citizens. And I think they see themselves as Arabs, as part of the broader Arab world. But I don't fully understand, even though I've been working with them, I don't fully understand Bedouin culture. And I think that there's a strong element in Bedouin culture of telling people what they want to hear, and that's not necessarily what's going on. I don't think they have such a strong nationalist consciousness, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, You have to go.
Yeah.
And so I think what I'll do is I'll say goodbye to you and then maybe on my own talk about the power plan a little bit and explain that to listeners, and then that would be a good way to...
I was hinting at that. There's nothing we haven't spoken about.
And this one, unless you have, do you feel like
that's
you have time
one.
To talk about it?
Until Miriam shows up, a few words. The power plan is about the Negev, but the biggest population of Bedouin in this area is not in the West Bank. It's in the Negev. And the government sees, the government is wanting to move army bases out of the center of the country into the Negev, and the Bedouin are in the way. They also want to develop new, there's a shortage of housing in Israel, and there's been a move, Be'er Sheva is growing, of young Israelis looking for cheaper housing who don't want to live, it may be racism, it may be other things, they don't want to live amongst Arabs. They don't want to live in the West Bank, even though the religious Zionists try and get them to go there. So there are these places where they want to develop towns for Jews, and despite the claiming to be a liberal democracy, there's an aspect of separation of populations going on. Power plan, it's called something different by now. Power plan was a plan to relocate Bedouin in the Negev to certain areas, in exchange for recognition of 40 villages, which at the moment, and this is a scandal, are not recognized. What does that mean, they're not recognized? It means that they don't have town plans, they're not set up to be connected with the electricity grid, the water system, they're neglected shanty towns. Now, part of what's going on there is neglect. Part of what's going on there, the Bedouin have huge families. They still practice polygamy, have lots of kids, and they have an ideology or a traditional notion of spreading out. Every time someone takes a new wife, has kids, they have to build a new, set up a tent, and they want the next hill and the next hill. So the right-wing people have been saying this, but there's some truth. They've been spreading out and growing in population. So there's a clash between the needs of Israel and the needs of the Bedouin. And the power plan, the big criticism of the power plan was that, our criticism, is they don't engage the Bedouin in having any voice in their own fate. So the government, until this huge period of nothing happening because of elections and coalition negotiations, it was trying to carry out the same plan that was publicly criticized and shelved by Netanyahu because of that criticism. But quietly, they're still trying to push Bedouin into certain areas. And the Bedouin, most of the ones in the non-recognized villages, did not take the bait of accepted recognition in exchange for limitation of area of growth. I hope that helps understand.
Yeah, that's great. So that's basically what the calls are, is to recognize the unrecognized villages, to halt the demolitions and forced evictions, to engage in meaningful dialogue with the Bedouin community and the Arab leadership, and invest in health, education, and employment opportunities for their Bedouin citizens of Israel.
Yeah, that's what we need, in my opinion.
Yeah.
That's what the government claims it wants to do.
Yeah.
But there's an underside to what's happening. You know, they usually get some ex-colonel or something to run the Bedouin stuff, and they're very... they're not sensitive to the Bedouin side of the story, and they talk to those leaders that are convenient for them, not to leaders of the unrecognized villages, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things we did as a group with the coalition of other groups was bring some of those leaders to the Knesset to speak to one of the committees of the Knesset. Then he wasn't a minister, Begin, the son of Menachem Begin, Benny Begin, was given the responsibility by Netanyahu to deal with his plan. And he was publicly embarrassed because he publicly said, at that committee meeting, I spoke to the Bedouin, and there were sitting leaders unrecognized in the villages opposite him saying, no, you did not talk to us.
Mm.
He resigned after that.
Wow. yeah, if you want to read more about that on the internet, you can check out adala.org, which is A-D-A-L-A. ALAH.org. There's a lot of great information on there. Is there any kind of last things you want to say about everything or anything?
You know, there are a lot of people working on this, and people should see that even though the left is small in Israel, it's active. And we're talking about thousands of people involved in all sorts of NGOs, and not just demonstrations, but political activism. But Rabbis Human Rights has a unique contribution to make as a religious voice in this group. We have an uphill struggle because our community is further to the right, that we're on the periphery of. We really need support of people overseas, and think that things aren't going to get better here if it's left up to just Israelis and Palestinians, unfortunately. So I think the whole world is involved in this. This is a really serious conflict. It's not just about Jewish and Arab nationalism. It's about the three major monotheistic religions of the world. And God forbid, you know, a third world war could start from here if someone blows up that building on the hill in the center of Jerusalem. To go back to our first subject. I always say the same thing, and I want to believe it, that just as religion is something that's making this conflict intractable and inflaming emotions because of people's belief in absolute, they have an absolute truth in their passions, so too religion can contribute in the other direction as an antidote to the poison of that religious extremism. Because all of major religions also have teachings and followers who believe that, you know, peace and justice is what God wants from us.
Thank you so much for your time, and thank you for listening. Be sure to listen next week when I talk with Rafat Sobleben about a personal account of living in the old city and the eviction order against his house. If you want to learn more about that right now, check out avaz.org, avaaz.org, and it's Help Save Nora's Home. Thanks again. Bye for now.